If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As I'm sure you already know, this podcast is produced by the team behind BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. And if you haven't had a chance to get hold of our magazine recently, we'd like to offer you the chance to get a copy of our next issue absolutely free. Please text the word HISTORY to 78070 to request your free magazine today. One of our team will be in touch to organise delivery direct to your door. This offer is available for a limited time only and only available for UK residents. So please don't miss out. Text HISTORY to 78070 to get your free copy today. Just a quick note, texts are normally charged at your standard network rate. Please check with your provider for further details. And welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's interview is with Dr. James Chetwood, a lecturer in medieval history at the University of Hull and an expert in personal names in the Middle Ages. Our content director, David Musgrove, put in a call to him to find out more. We have some bonus content with this podcast, which is available exclusively on our website. So if you'd like to know the most popular names in the 11th and 14th centuries, and to hear some of the ruder names that Dr. Chetwood has uncovered, go to historyextra.com/exclusive-podcasts. Please be aware that this bonus material does contain some graphic language.
Today, I'm talking to Dr. James Chetwood, who is currently lecturing in medieval history at the University of Hull. James is a historian and linguist whose research focuses on language and social history of the medieval period from around about 700 to 1300, with a particular focus on personal names and naming patterns. And his thesis, his doctoral thesis, with a brilliant title, Tom, Dick and Leofric, The Transformation of English Personal Naming, circa 800 to circa 1300, is brilliant. So, James, thank you for joining us.
No problem. Thank you. Yeah, nice to know someone other than my mum's read it. So that's good news.
We're going to talk about your research in a bit of detail. But first, how do you go about studying personal names? What sort of resources do you look at to drill into that?
Oh, good question. At this period, it's tricky, really, because there's not sort of a set of consolidated records of people's lives and people who lived. So you're really looking through any type of document that just happens to have a list of names. And those change throughout the period I look at. So I start in the sort of early medieval period, from around the 7th, 8th century. And actually the most common source of names are things called confraternity books or Libri Vitae, and they are essentially books of lives of people connected to a religious foundation of some sort, so usually a monastery. So one of the ones I've looked at in detail is from Durham, but there's a number of others from around England, in New Minster, in Winchester, and then another one in Thorney Abbey, which is just after the Conquest. And these are essentially just people's names written down in a book or a manuscript to remember people who have lived. Usually they're monks, but they could also be benefactors, or and also they usually have lists of kings and queens and bishops and abbots and that sort of thing. As you go through the period, from sort of the 11th century, 10th, 11th century onwards, you get more things that are sort of administrative records. So things like Doomsday Book, but other records, the Winton Doomsday, which is a similar type of record of people and lands that they owned and tax that they owed, that sort of thing. And then as you get through to the 14th century, there's loads more records. Essentially what I'm looking at is a set of completely different records than trying to pull them all together and use the names as the sources themselves, if that makes sense. But the prerequisite is there has to be a list of names, and there has to be quite a lot of them.
So let's go into the story a bit. So you start your research, as you said, around about the year 800, and sort of setting the scene. That's England in the year 800 is about to enter a period of some turmoil with the Viking incursions and that sort of thing about to happen. And to be clear, your research focuses on England, or what is now England exclusively, rather than the other constituent parts of Britain.
Yeah, obviously England at that time wasn't England as it is now, but essentially, yeah. So all my sources come from what we would now call England. Although one of the things I've tried to do quite, essentially the main aim is to look at how England compares to other parts of continental Europe and try and see if there's any comparisons or contrast that can be drawn between what's happening here and what's happening there. Although it does focus on names that were recorded in England, I've tried to compare across regions as much as possible within that. And obviously within English, defining an English name is a very difficult thing, as I found throughout the period. What is English changes a huge amount. So there's never just English names in any of the sources I look at. There's names from all sorts of different areas, predominantly people who lived in England, but some of them were obviously migrants or immigrants from other parts of Europe, including Ireland and Scotland and Wales and other parts of continental Europe.
Okay, we'll get on to how you would recognise those different sorts of names maybe in a second, but I'm just going to quote a little paragraph from the start of your research, which I think is quite instructive. You say, it's widely agreed that in the early 9th century, the people of England adhered to traditional Germanic principles of name-giving, where diathematic, I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, compound names were created by combining two themes taken from the language of everyday vocabulary. So can you simplify that for us? What are we talking
about?
Yeah,
there's lots of terms that are sort of tricky to define anyway, because England didn't exist and Germanic's quite a problematic term. But essentially, Germanic languages are a family of, if you look at it as the family of languages that exist in the Germanic group of languages. English is one of those, but within that also sit West Germanic. Common West Germanic is the precursor to Old English, as well as Germanic languages in places like Germany and sort of Frisia, sort of the Netherlands, as we call it now. And they also have Northern Germanic names in Scandinavia. But the principles they used of naming were essentially to combine two words and put them together. And that's a very common way of creating a name. It's the same process as used in Greek, for example, but putting two elements of language and putting them together to create a name. So, and usually those names, those themes, those name elements would have had a meaning that was initially at least sort of understandable to the people using them. One very famous example is King Ethelred, whose name was made up of the theme Ethel, meaning noble, and red, meaning council. So putting that together, in theory at least, in origin, gave the meaning noble council. So some common names that people might be familiar with are things like Leofwin. Leof is the precursor to the modern English word love, but it means beloved or a friend, and win as well, I think. So Leofwin, Eilf, rich, Eilf meaning elf, rich meaning riches, and Eilf red as well. So what the way it worked was that the number of themes that you could create names with was limited. But by combining them in lots of different ways meant you could create a huge number of names. So obviously, Eilf rich, Eilf red, and Leof rich and Leof red are using a small number of themes, but by piecing them together, you get a larger number of names.
Yeah, I gotcha. And was that, so is that a similar sort of process that was going on across the channel then in the Low Countries and in Germany?
Yeah, exactly. So, for example, William, the common modern English name William, comes from a common West Germanic name formed of themes, essentially, which were Wilhelm, which in German exists as Wilhelm now. Those two themes also existed in Old English in a slightly different form, but we have pre-conquest people named using the same two themes. So the themes in those both sort of language groups had similar meanings and were almost could be deemed cognates. So had the same meanings and were usually formed in the same way. Didn't necessarily mean you came up with exactly the same names, but quite often the themes which they were created with were originally the same.
Okay, and you mentioned sort of the North Germanic languages and the Scandinavians, and that sort of brings in the Vikings a little bit there in that sense. And you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but there is the tradition in that language group of having patronymic names, so they have to have son or daughter at the end of their names. That is that not a theme that we see in the Old English?
This is one of the things that I was trying to look at, although it's only part of what I've been looking at. But yeah, the process of creating patronymic names or bynames that refer to another member of the family is actually quite a later phenomenon, at least in the period I'm looking at. So actually, one of the key things about names in the sort of 700s, 800s is that people only had one name. So they didn't have a by name or a systematic by name or surname added to it like we have today. So my name's James Chetwood. The Chetwood bit wouldn't exist. I'd just be James. And this is perhaps one of the reasons why people had a wider variety of names. You have a wider variety of names. By having a wider variety of names, you didn't need to have a surname. And that's the same in Scandinavia, actually. So the development of by names, both as nicknames or nicknames and relationship names, including parental patronyms and matronyms, starts to come in around the 10th century. So in Scandinavia that happens, and that happens in England as well at the same time, as well as on the continent, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, absolutely. But yeah. So I find that very interesting because I was just thinking before I got onto you, thinking about prehistory actually, and about theories that archaeologists have about, say, in the Neolithic period, when it's assumed there was some sort of settlement of incomers coming in, and they built monuments in the landscape, and those monuments were deemed to sort of be in some way linking to the ancestors. They put the bones of the ancestors in there, and that was all part of an idea of linking that group of people with that bit of land. So using the ancestors. The question of the Anglo-Saxon Germanic settlement into England is a thorny one, and it's not clear as to exactly what happened there. But you would imagine that if there were groups of people who had fairly recently come to an area, they would want to stress their legitimacy to be there, and a way to do that would be through some sort of ancestral naming situation. That's a very long-winded idea that's very ill-informed. But is there nothing in that?
We do have evidence of group names for a group of people. So sort of perhaps you might want to call it a clan name or an extended family unit. And this is how, one of the things that I think changes the way that families and sort of communities are built and structured, changes, which changes the way people use names. So we do have evidence of family names in a sense referring to a family group, but that's not applied in the same systematic way. And when we see names listed down, we don't see names listed as a surname or alongside a first name. It's just a name. So they would be Leofwyn or Aelfrich or Leofrich, and you wouldn't have a surname added to it.
Okay.
In this period anyway. And one of the key things actually I should mention is that what the system of creating these diathematic names is not just to mean that there was a limited repetition of names amongst people who were alive, but actually also what we found out, or what I've looked at in different family trees and genealogies, is that there's very, very little repetition of names throughout a family as well. So today you might name your son or daughter after a grandparent or an uncle or an auntie. What we see is this doesn't happen, at least not in the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries. People try and avoid naming children after living relatives, which might be to do with very different reasons, but there's no passing down of names in the same way as there is today. And that's one of the key things that changes over the period that I look at names.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your research a theory by somebody called Regine Lejeune, who suggested that it was due to some Germanic belief in the indivisibility of body and spirit, and a fear that you would be in some way, I don't know, doing a disservice to your ancestors if you took their name, I suppose.
Yeah, I think there is something to that, although I don't think that can be the only reason. She explains that there is this idea that, yeah, people having the same name as someone else is essentially stealing their, or it's always like stealing their soul, stealing their essence and their individuality. Yeah. But there's also she also explains that she thinks this changes as Christianity takes over from Germanic paganism. And we do see some changes that happen at that point, but actually this attempt or the system of keeping names as individual as possible and unrepeated lasts a long time into the Christian periods in various parts of Western Europe. And a lot of people in places like France never became pagans. They were always Christian, but they still used this Germanic system of diathematic naming. So it doesn't quite work, I don't think. So we have to look at other reasons for why this change took place.
Okay. And then just one other thing on this. Going back to the Scandinavians again, I'm afraid, they have these, some of them have the exciting nicknames like, you know, Skull Splitter and Hairy Breeches and things like that. Do we not see anything of that in these early names?
The names that I've looked at, not early, not very early, but we do see these coming in over the period. So I think you start to see a sort of more systematic use of by names or additional names, including nicknames, from the 10th century onwards. 9th, 10th century, we start to see them coming in. Some of them are very fun, some of them are very boring. But so Skull Splitter, there might have been 10th century people called John's, not John, but the Aelfrich Skull Splitter. I haven't found any, but I have found some with some interesting by names.
Okay, maybe we'll come back to that later on. And then by names would also be potentially occupational based.
There are five key types of by names, if I can remember them. So there's a relationship by name. So they may be patronymic or referring to a father, but also potentially a mother or sometimes another relative or just another relationship they have with someone. Then there are nicknames. So nicknames, just as we use them today, essentially made up names to do with someone's characteristics or life. There are locational names based around a location of where you live or where you've come from, or a location within the landscape. Which ones haven't I done? Occupational names referring to what that person does for a living, but it might also link to where they're from. So if they're where they live, if you're the priest, you might be called the priest, and you might know that person lives in the church or next to the church, because that's the names can tell you more than one thing.
That's sort of the situation sketched out in the year 800. And now we're going to leap on right to the end of your period, and 500 years later. Completely different sort of picture, at least to my untutored eye, in terms of these things. And, you know, We've moved from everyone being called, you know, Leofwin or Athelbert or whatever it is, to everyone being called Richard, William, Robert, those sorts of names. I'm talking men here. We should talk about women's names as well, obviously. So how did that happen? So there's a 500-year gap. Lots of things happened there. A very simple take would be that 1066 happened and there was a big continental flood of influence in all aspects of society. And that was sort of washed away old English names and brought in some new names that sound different to me. You're going to tell me that's not the case and it's far more complicated than that. So do your best.
Yeah, well, that's a very sensible and logical explanation for lots of things that happen. And partly because part of it is completely true. The 1066 does happen, and there is an influx of names from the continent, and they do change the names that people are using. So that is correct. I don't think it has much impact or any impact on this idea that people were started to choose names that made people be like other people. So choosing names that other people had. I think that thing is already happening before the Norman Conquest. And also the names that we have that were in existence in the 13th and 14th century, most of them didn't come over after the Norman Conquest, because the very popular ones that had started to become popular by the 13th, 14th century were Christian names or religious names or of Greek, Roman or biblical origins related to saints, essentially, or biblical figures. And these names don't really start to become very popular until the early 13th century onwards. So actually we see a number of shifts. First, we see a shift from Old English Germanic names to continental Germanic names. So things like William, things like Richard, things like Robert, that are the same type of name, but from a different linguistic background, if that makes sense. So they're from, they are Norman names in as much as they are carried by Norman people, but they are linguistically Germanic. We also see lots and lots of common West Germanic sort of Norman names that come over to England but don't become popular, like Anderbodo and Ebrard and Herewig. These names also come over and die out in the same way as Old English names. And then from the 13th, 14th century, we also see a sharp increase in the number of Latin, biblical, Greek names related to Christianity. So names like John, names like Thomas, and names like Martin and Michael and Stephen, that sort of thing. Very quickly, they start to be the names that are related to the sort of big Europe-wide saints in many cases, but also in some cases, very popular local saints like Thomas in England.
So I was going to ask you that. So today, obviously, naming is driven quite often by celebrities. You know, you get loads of Davids when David Beckham's really good at football, that sort of thing. Is that same phenomenon happening in our period, but more akin to saints and kings, I guess, than footballers?
Yes and no. I do think this idea that people are starting to name people after other people has that effect. It's very difficult sometimes to work out who those people are, because as soon as there are lots of people called Robert, which Robert are you naming it after? The initial influence of names like William, Robert and Richard is quite clearly the Norman dukes and their family. So that William the Conqueror's brother of Robert and Richard, and these are very popular names in Normandy, and they become very popular names in England. But obviously Robert and Richard were never kings of England. So actually what I think is happening is there's a sort of level of society that's got a lot of power and influence over people in their locality, sort of local landlords. And as these names start to be borne by sort of important people in local areas, initially they start being taken on by just normal English people in those areas. So Robert and Richard become very popular, but Henry doesn't actually become that popular till much, much later, even though there are kings, very important kings called Henry. John becomes very, very, very popular, but no one liked King John. So it's not quite as simple as naming it after the king. I think they are naming them after some people, but not necessarily the most important one, if that makes sense. I think there is more local and regional elements to it. As we get to the later period of the 14th century, I do think there is sort of a Europeanization, centralization of the, at least the religious names that you get. So I think John's the most popular name in the whole of Europe. And that's a sort of a broader phenomenon than someone being called Robert after their landlord. But as I say, it gets very difficult because as soon as there's 50 people called John in your village, you might be naming it after your cousin John or your uncle John or your, I don't know, John the priest.
Yeah. Makes sense. But there are certain sort of bits and episodes in history where everyone does seem to have the same name. Like there's a Matilda's just, you know, everywhere for a little while and Williams and Roberts, as you say. So
yeah,
that must have complicated matters somewhat for people. I'm just reminded actually. So just thinking about the conquest, specifically in pre-conquest period, there are some instances of people changing their names or at least having double names when they come from Normandy to England. So I'm thinking of Queen Emma changing her name to Elfgifu, I think. Is that just a one-off or
that happens more often than you would think, and it happens the other way around as well. But there is a so despite the fact that in the early period these names were cognate, the Old English names and Continental Germanic names had the same name elements that you might be able to recognise. Clearly by the 11th century this wasn't the case, and the English names seemed very foreign to people in Normandy and vice versa. So Emma's one example, who took the name Eofgifu or Alviva, even though there was millions of Elvivas, so it's not this idea that we're giving her a name.
Another example there of yeah. That was they dominated
exactly.
The story.
And I think yeah, I mean, I know Harold Godwinson had a wife called Elviva, I think. I can't even remember now. There's so many of them.
Yeah,
But yeah, so it shows that actually they're picking names to fit in, not to stand out, which is very different to what was happening 200 years later. So by giving her the same name as very lots of other people in the same place at the same time, it's making her try and fit in. Audric Vitalis is another famous example. He was called Audrich, which is an Old English name, and he was born in the early 12th century, and he moved to a monastery in Normandy and took the name Vitalis because the monks there couldn't pronounce his name, which seems unbelievable, but that's what they said. There's also a case of a young boy who ended up being called Bartholomew Farn, a saint, in his life. He was originally called Tosti, so the same name as the brother of Harold Godwinson, who betrayed him just before the Battle of Hastings. And the young boy Tosti, who was to be Bartholomew, changed his own name to William because all his friends were essentially taking the mick out of him because Tosti was such an unfashionable name. This was in the early 12th century, so. Yeah, there's definitely an element of fashion. People had fashionable names and were naming children after other people. And in that case, that name had happened to go out of fashion quite quickly. So he chose a different one for himself.
Presumably this whole story does play into the changing language itself, which obviously modifies substantially from 800 to 1300. And you were talking about people being unable to pronounce foreign sounding names. I mean, that must have been quite a big issue post-conquest, I would imagine.
We definitely see the name forms themselves change before Old English names are discarded. They change in form before and after the conquest, and this is where it becomes quite difficult to understand because a lot of the sources we have just after the conquest are French-speaking scribes writing Old English names down, which might mean that some names are simplified or transformed in the way they understand them. But I think there's also been a change already. So names like, you mentioned Eofgifu or Eofgifu,
yeah.
Which is the traditional old English form, as it would have been in a diathematic name, that had sort of transformed by the time of the conquest to something to Alviva. And the same with Leofgifu had become Leviva. There we have a tendency to sort of transcribe or put these names back to what they would have been in the early Old English period, when actually a name like Leofwin may have been Leofwin or Lewin. And actually we see names, a lot of the names that, the only way we see names, old English names, very often these days are in surnames. So we know, someone called Lewinson is the son of someone called Leofwin or the sort of the descendant of that name. So Lewinson is Leofwin's son, but it had been already been contracted by the time it got put into a surname.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Most people, for most of history, stay in roughly the same place and roughly stay at the same social status. That might be a controversial thing to say, but actually surnames are a very good way of working out where someone comes from originally until around the Industrial Revolution. And there's not a huge amount of social mobility.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
We should talk about women's names. I mean, we've talked about some women's names there. Is there any difference at all in the way things work between male and female names? And does that tell us anything at all about social attitudes?
I think the biggest thing we can tell from social attitudes is that women were less important because we have far fewer women's names written down. Obviously, there were roughly the same amount of women as men, we could assume, but there are a fraction of the names, which is why it was really difficult for me to do the same sort of quantitative studies of names of women, because while I found sources with sort of sometimes 3,000, sometimes a couple of hundred names of men, those the equivalent of women would have been sometimes maybe 20, sometimes none at all. So a quantitative study of names before the conquest is very difficult. I think we can see similar processes in as much as there is a contraction of the naming stock before the conquest around a popular set of names from what we can see. And actually, one of the interesting things some people have picked up on is that we see a slower switch to Norman or continental names after the conquest amongst female names. So they hold women's names remain sort of pre-conquest for a little bit longer. Why that is, we're not entirely sure, and that's one of the things that I want to look at in more detail. And I think the big change that we see in men's names by the 14th century is that they're very, very concentrated. So in for example, I looked at a source in York where there's 800, 900 people, and there's about 40 names shared across those 800, 900 people, and most people share about five names. So 50, 60% are called the same five names, which is a huge amount of concentration of names. We see that happen amongst women, but not to the same extent. So there's much more variety in the names that they're given, in as much as the popular names aren't as popular, but although there's a more creativity in the names that they get.
Okay, so that must have been ridiculous in that case in York, where basically everyone is called the same name. And that's I guess, where you need surnames coming in to differentiate people.
This is, it is ridiculous, but it's not uncommon. That's just the way it was, which is sort of why I wanted to look at the change. So you go from, in around 700-800, everyone had a different name, to around 1300-1400, where everyone has the same name. So there's obviously a big shift in the way people were choosing names, whether people realised it or not. And it is ridiculous. Unfortunately, that the idea that people added surnames to help distinguish between people is, again, is very logical and it makes sense, but it doesn't necessarily seem to be backed up by the evidence. Studies in France and on the continent, and from what I can see and what I've looked at, you get surnames before you need them and for people that don't need them.
Right.
So people with very uncommon names may have a surname, but people with very common names may not, if that makes sense. So I think people are being given surnames and bynames before they need them for different reasons. And actually, it might be the other way around, that once people have a surname, have surnames, it's easier to discard some of the extraneous given names, if that makes sense.
Sure. So at what point, if at all, would you say that most people have surnames?
It depends when you buy a surname. So I think, and it depends where you are, that and in what part of society you're in. So I think we can safely say that in the upper echelons of society, it happens a bit quicker that you all get a surname. And in lower echelons and also in sort of northern parts of the country, it's a little bit slower. I think most people would have had a hereditary surname by around the 15th century of some sort or another. But it goes through a process of sort of systematically applied bynames. So a byname isn't hereditary. It's something that you're given during your life. It may refer to your father, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that name gets passed down. So my dad's called Graham. So I would be James. I might be called James Graham's son, but then my son would be called something Jameson. So it's not a surname as we know it. So that systematic application of bynames happens earlier. And it's where people are given a name, a byname as part of their identity. And then at some point in the next sort of 150 years, that develops into a hereditary surname. But then both of these exist together. Even way after this, people are still getting sort of single-use bynames, as it were, and we still get them today in the form of nicknames.
Yeah. Just so, this is way after your period, but so when is our actual, our naming structure that we have today, when is that established? If you don't know the answer, don't worry about it.
No, I think so. In terms of a given name and a hereditary surname, probably arrived around the end of the medieval period. That's just about in place, and actually, that's when you can start tracking the tracking surnames back to their origin. We know that some people are with common surnames all descended from an individual with that surname. So I think everyone called Metcalf, they can work out where the original Metcalf was in the 13th century in somewhere in, I think it's Lancashire or West Yorkshire, I can never remember. And it's almost passed down like I think it's the Y chromosome that gets passed down. And if you can track it all the way throughout their gene, that gene pool, track it across that descendant. So all, however many, 500,000 Metcalfs all come from the same point in the medieval period.
Okay, good for the Metcalfs.
I don't know why I know Metcalf.
Let's hope there's some Metcalfs listening. What about, you mentioned sort of higher born and lower born people. Are there names that are more associated with certain statuses in life that you can see?
Obviously, the occupational names are related to someone, and I think that would actually be when they are still being given as a as a sort of creative process in someone's life. They very much would indicate their social status. Some of these are ironic, so though you get people called King and Baron who are quite clearly not kings or barons. So it might be that they're very poor, actually. So they've got a nickname that shows that they are very poor. And it might be just something to do with their character. But obviously, if you are someone called Tanner, that shows that you have a job. So you're not the lowest of the low. You've got a profession, but obviously that's not quite as prestigious as a smith. If that makes sense. So a smith would be one up, a priest would be one more up. So actually, they're very good tools at indicating an individual social status. But you're right that obviously once they become hereditary, we can see that most people, for most of history, stay in roughly the same place and roughly stay at the same social status. That might be a controversial thing to say, but actually surnames are a very good way of working out where someone comes from originates, because most people stay in roughly the same part of the country until around the Industrial Revolution. And there's not a huge amount of social mobility. So yeah, there are patterns to do with that. I'm not an expert in that bit, but yeah, you can definitely see.
And just leading on from that, what about the question of ethnicity or national affiliation or you know, saying that you're part of some sort of group? How far do you see that? I mean, we talked at the start about surnames or names that were more Celtic in stock and continental in stock versus the old English ones. How far can you see that sort of attribution?
Yeah, it's names are both brilliant and terrible at indicating where someone is, given names anyway, indicating ethnicity, because they're very malleable. You can call a child anything you want, really. That's not true. In quite a few modern countries, people have a restriction on what you can call your children. But I could call my child a German name, even though I'm not German. My daughter has a Scottish name, and I am a very small part of Scottish. My grandma was Scottish, she was from Orkney, but she ran away to the Isle of Wight when she was 15. So very not Scottish, but she's got a Scottish name. So you might assume that I'm more Scottish than I am by my daughter's name. And she's not Scottish at all. So actually, for the first couple of generations, I think they're really good tools. So if you look at the sources in sort of Domesday in the late 11th century, maybe just after that, we can quite clearly see Norman names becoming in, and we can sort of look at an influence. And the same just before the conquest, we can see areas where there's a high level of Scandinavian names, and you can say that there must have been some sort of Scandinavian influence there. But after a few generations, it's very hard to remember what people were called. We can't really imagine what it was like, what the people were called 100 years ago until you look. I have family members, I looked at my family tree, people that I call Elspeth, which just seems like a completely alien name to me. I'd never know anyone called Elspeth, but that was a common name then. Within a few generations, I think it's very difficult for people to remember what names were like before. So by 1150, particularly by 1200, Richard, Robert and Thomas are good old-fashioned English names in the same way they are today. And you wouldn't say that someone called Richard is French now, but it's a French name in the 1100s. So they're very good tools at working out in the short term if there's been influence from migration. But very quickly that usefulness disappears.
Okay, there's a bunch more questions I wanted to ask you, but we're running out of time. So there's just one more that I really wanted to get to you on, which is this idea of the changing names showing a changing nature of what should we say, communality over the period, and a sort of a growth in community and communal values towards the latter part of your period. Am I right in that? And tell me about that.
Yeah, no, that I think that's definitely the case. Lots of things change a lot in 500 years. That's what happens in history. What it seems to me is that There are clearly a lot of changes that happen in the way people live their lives. But one of the key ones is where they live their lives and who they live them with. In the 600s, 700s, settlements were very dispersed. So by and large, people would live in very small settlements with maybe an extended family group and maybe a couple of other extended family groups in close proximity. But essentially, there were people would be living amongst small groups that weren't very connected to lots of people. From the 9th, 10th century onwards in England, but also actually in most of continental Europe and actually in much of the islands of Britain and Ireland, there are more people and they start to live closer together in what we now know as villages. More people living together in a much more intense fashion for various different reasons, but mainly because there was more people and they needed to create more food, more surplus, and that sort of thing. But ultimately, most people were either in a nuclear settlement or in a much more tightly inhabited area. So you might not have immediate next door neighbours, but you might all be linked to the same church that you all go to. So where Christianity does come in, I think, is that creation of a community that is ultimately based around a manorial system, but also a parish church system. And the fact that people end up living, particularly by the 12th, 13th century, their lives in full view of each other all the time, either in the fields that they're working to create food in shared common fields, in the same communal spaces, going to church, that sort of thing, all having the same common landlord, creates a society where being like people is more beneficial. Whether you want to see that as a good thing, is that, oh yeah, community values and we want to, we're all in this together, or whether you just don't want to stand out. But we see across Europe, but particularly in England, because I've looked at it, a greater propensity to try and be like the people in their immediate location. The way I've seen it is that people start to have the same name. And it's way more than people share the same name today, but to much lesser degree. I've talked about villages there, but the same thing applies in towns as well.
That was Dr. James Chetwood of the University of Hull, speaking to Dave Musgrove. If you'd like to listen to the bonus content about the most popular and rudest names that Dr. Chetwood has found, go to historyextra.com/exclusive-podcasts. But again, please be aware that this bonus content does come with an explicit warning for graphic language. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Friday when Jonathan Fennell will be discussing the Second World War in the East.